Well, hi, I'm Matt, one of the Mainbridge staff. Really great to have the privilege of speaking to you today. We're doing a series at the moment where each Sunday we're looking at the life of Jesus through Matthew's Gospel. And today is quite important because although we're a few weeks into the series now, this is actually the first time in the book where we meet Jesus as a grown-up. So far in Matthew, we've heard his family history, the story of his birth, people come and visit him, and his family end up as refugees in Egypt for a while, and then they come back to Israel, and pretty much from that point, nothing really happens for about 25 or so years. And then at the start of chapter 3, we hear about what Jesus' cousin, who historically became known as John the Baptist, is up to, what he's doing. John is this really quirky man, quite an unusual bloke. He lives out in the countryside, baptizing people, and they come to him in droves, literally thousands of them. It's this unprecedented, strange thing. Suddenly there's this spiritual thirst in the country, and loads of people have the sense they need to get right with God somehow, and they show up in the middle of nowhere and speak with John. They hear about what he has to say about God, and they get baptized, because baptism was this outward ritual. It meant that you wanted to be cleansed in some way to put your sin, your wrongdoing behind you. So there's loads of people show up in the middle of nowhere to meet John and do this. And so John has this very influential thing going. He becomes well known. Everyone really respects him. But as we saw last week, he himself was very humble. He says, look, someone's coming. And I tell you what, I'm not even good enough to be his slave. I'm immersing you in water. That's what baptism was, physically speaking. But he says, this guy's going to come and he's going to immerse you in the Spirit of God. Instead of being covered in water, when this guy comes along, you're going to get covered in God, so to speak. And John's saying, look, this is levels above me. This is not my pay grade. This is a whole other thing. And so the anticipation builds around who this character is going to be. We also saw in previous weeks that in Jewish thinking, for hundreds of years, they're waiting for a Messiah, unusual word. They're waiting for a Messiah, this heroic figure. The Old Testament has promised that somebody's coming. They've been waiting for hundreds of years. It's all building up. And we've still not met adult Jesus in this story. After his birth, few little bits about his childhood. We don't know. We're not told what Jesus has been doing at all. What we can piece together is he's grown up in the small northern town of Nazareth. It's this little unfashionable place. He's worked with his dad as a labourer, probably a carpenter. Luke's gospel tells us that up to the age of 30, that's what Jesus is doing. And that's when he begins his public ministry. Now, you might think after all these years of apparently being this special person, this Messiah, and yet having no public profile, Jesus would announce himself to the world with some great show of power or some incredible wisdom. He'd get it on his Instagram feed and TikTok and so on. He'd have a press conference. That is precisely not what Jesus does. It's not what he does at all. What we're about to see tells us exactly how Jesus, the one who millions of people around the world call the King of everything, who people worship as God, how he begins his ministry. And in just a few words, it tells us everything that he's all about. It tells everything he's all about. So this is Matthew chapter 3, beginning in verse 13. Then Jesus came from Galilee to the Jordan to be baptized by John. But John tried to deter him, saying, I need to be baptized by you, and you come to me. So this is the first line in Matthew where the adult Jesus does something that we know about. He travels from the Galilee region, that's the north of Israel, that's where Nazareth was, to the Jordan River. Now, the Jordan River runs north to south for quite a lot of the length of Israel. And it's not one of these big, fast-moving rivers with rapids and stuff. It's a very gentle, very narrow thing. I've actually been kayaking down it. It's very, very peaceful, very relaxed. So John's standing in the river. That would have been very easy to do. And he's using it to baptize anybody that wants to be baptized, anybody that feels that they want to be made right with God. And that means that the first thing that Jesus does is really very unexpected. Jesus has been set up as this amazing person. He's supposed to be this Messiah. And so surely he's a great ruler, a powerful leader, someone who commands respect instantaneously. Why would he show up at this piddly little river, stand in it and say, look, John, I want to go through this humble ceremony that people are doing to show that they want their sin to be washed away? Why would he show up and say this? It's very important. In fact, it's key to the whole Christian thing that Jesus was without sin, that his attitudes and his actions and his approach, in none of those things did he ever go against God's ways, that he never did anything wrong. And if that's true, why does Jesus need to be baptized? Why is he doing this? And John is, like everybody else, asking the same question. And you have to remember as well, John has just been bigging up Jesus to the crowds. John's been saying, look, well, I'm down here, he's up there. And now Jesus shows up out of nowhere and is saying, John, will you baptize me as well, please? So John is very confused. Maybe he's even a bit embarrassed. Maybe there's people standing around just scratching their chin saying, what's all of this? And John's maybe taken to one side to whisper to him, look, I don't get this, Jesus. This is the wrong way round. I just told all these people I'm not good enough to be your slave, and now you want me to publicly baptize you. That just doesn't feel right. That doesn't feel like how it's supposed to be. John is just incredibly humble. He's a man with significant profile and influence at this point. And at this moment, he's actually far more famous and revered than Jesus is. And he's saying, Jesus, I'm not good enough to baptize you. I can't. I know who you are, I'm not good enough. Just, he has this amazing humility. But even John, with all his insight at this moment, doesn't understand how revolutionary the way of Jesus will be. I'm not picking on John there. Nobody would have realized if they were in his shoes at that moment. But when John resists baptizing Jesus, it's because he thinks that Jesus is out there, he's up there, he's too glorious. And that's true, but as Jesus will demonstrate, in the ways of God, glory is all about serving and coming alongside and doing low-key, humble things. Jesus knows this very well, so we see this in his reply. Jesus replied, "Let it be so now. It is proper for us to do this to fulfill all righteousness." And then John consented. So these are the first words of Jesus in the New Testament. Righteousness, bit of a funny word, long word, and it's usually not associated with good things in our culture. The most common place we probably use that word is when we accuse someone of self-righteousness, which is certainly not a good thing normally. But righteousness in the Bible is not quite like that. Righteousness in the Bible, it's complicated, and scholars debate about the nuance of what it means. But a good simple way of thinking about it for our purposes today is to think of it as the good ways of God. Righteousness is the good ways of God. And Jesus wants to be baptized to fulfill the good ways of God. How does him being baptized do that? Well, it gets debated quite a lot, probably a few things. One is that it affirms what John is doing. It shows everyone publicly that Jesus thinks this is a good thing. He's affirming it. It means that Jesus identifies with people. He's coming alongside and he's saying, like, I'm making myself one of everybody else. Yes, people are saying I'm a special person, but I'm making myself one of everybody else on this level too. But I think most of all, it's Jesus demonstrating the pattern of everything that he's about because he wants everybody who follows him to have a similar approach. The first thing Jesus does in public is humbly submit to a ritual that reminds us of humanity's need for God. That's what he's doing. And he sets the tone for everybody who has followed him since. Start with this. Start with admitting that God is greater, that we need him, that following in his ways is the antidote to the many problems of life. What a wonderful, counterintuitive way for the greatest person who ever lived to begin what he does. So far, so good. Story could maybe end there. But from this point, this is where things, from our point of view, get a little bit strange. Things get a bit supernatural, a little bit sort of outside the box of our normal thinking and expectation. As soon as Jesus was baptized, he went up out of the water. At that moment, heaven was opened, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and alighting on him. And a voice from heaven said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." So Jesus gets out of the river, he's still dripping wet, and the Spirit of God lands on him like a dove. It's this odd physical visual thing. And then there's this voice from heaven. It's the voice of God speaking over Jesus. What on earth is going on here? Where's all this stuff come from all of a sudden? In this scene, Matthew, the author, seems to be showing us three different characters. You've got Jesus, obviously, who Matthew clearly believed to be God incarnate, or God come to the world in human form, if you read the whole book. Then you've got the Spirit of God, another character who appears in some sort of physical way. He moves like a dove. He would have been understood to be God too. And then the third thing, you get this voice from heaven, which in Jewish thinking immediately meant God. A voice from heaven would be the voice of God. So all of a sudden, you've got three characters, three different characters, two of whom are doing some odd supernatural things, and they're all God. All these three characters would have been understood to be God. And yet, Matthew the author is a Jew. He only believes in one God. That's what he would have been brought up with his entire life. So what's he saying? Has he gone mad? What's he doing? We're going to have to get a little bit theological for a moment. A little bit complicated. But trust me, because this is really, really relevant to everyday life. This is really important. What we see acted out, what we see visible in this moment is the very complicated idea of the Trinity. The idea that God is somehow three and yet one. He's fully three persons and yet he's one. And here's the idea. God is one person, eternally existent in three persons. He's one God in three. And that's not something called tritheism with three gods who get on really well and, you know, they have get on really, you know, and work in harmony. And it's not unipersonalism, the idea that sometimes God takes one form and sometimes he takes another. In the Trinity, there is one God in three persons who know and love one another eternally. And this is not just a piece of nice theology that somebody developed. It means something for everybody practically. It's incredible. When in this passage, Matthew shows us the Trinity interacting, he's giving us a glimpse of not a small thing, but of the heart of reality. The central thing of the universe, the meaning of life, is found in what Matthew gives us a glimpse of here. The theologian Cornelius Plantinga, another theologian with a brilliant name, says, "The persons within God exalt each other, commune with each other, and defer to one another. Each divine person harbours the others at the centre of his being. In constant movement of overture and acceptance, each person envelops and encircles the others. God's interior life therefore overflows with regard for others." Do you see how incredible that is? The epicentre of all things is not cold, pointless nothingness, or even a singular God who creates the universe because he's a little bit lonely and needs something to do. No, it's a God who is in essence both one and a community of love. Understanding this is flipping difficult. I don't think anybody fully does that has ever lived, but there are some great insights out there that will help us understand why this is so important. One is the author and Oxford scholar C.S. Lewis, who imagined the three persons of God interacting with one another eternally, a bit like they're in a dance. And he wrote, "In Christianity, God is not a static thing, but a dynamic, pulsating activity, a life, almost a kind of drama. Almost, if you will not think me irreverent, a kind of dance." Now you might say, well, that sounds quite interesting, but why does it matter? What's it got to do with anything? And Lewis says, it matters more than anything else in the world. The whole dance or drama or pattern of this three-personal life is to be played out in each one of us. Joy, peace, eternal life are a great fountain of energy and beauty spurting up at the very centre of reality. Why the dance image? It's because if you think about this picture, a self-centred life is in a way it's a stationary life. A self-centred person wants to be the centre around which everything else orbits. They want to be in the middle of it all. And like we might say about somebody, you know, we might go, oh, you know, so-and-so, he thinks that the world revolves around him. And we know that that's a bad thing. And if I'm self-centred in life, you know, I might help people. I might have friends. I might fall in love, as long as there's no compromise in my own individual interests or whatever meets my needs. I might even give to the poor, as long as it makes me feel good about myself and doesn't hinder my lifestyle too much. You see, what this is getting at is that self-centred makes everything else a means to an end. And that end, that non-negotiable, is whatever, you know, whatever I want, whatever I like, my interests over everybody else's. I'll have fun with people, I'll talk to people, I'll even look after people on one level. But in the end, when it comes down to it, everything orbits around me and my preferences and how I want to go about things. And think about that more widely. If everyone is saying, no, you orbit around me, what happens? Imagine 5 people, 10 people, 100 people on a stage together, ready to dance, and every single one of them wants to be the centre. They all just stand there and say, well, you move around me, or you guys move around me. And of course that doesn't work. Nobody gets anywhere. The dance becomes a competition, not a collaboration. It's impossible. And we all know exactly what life looks like when everyone is competing to be the centre, because we experience it from other people, and we do it ourselves in lots of ways every single day of our lives. The Trinity Lewis is getting at is totally different. Instead of self-centeredness, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are in their very essence mutually self-giving. No person in the Trinity insists that the others revolve around him. Rather, each of them voluntarily circles and orbits around the others. It's beautiful. And it matters because God's very nature sets the pattern for us to live in. It matters because it's the foundation for what happens at Jesus' baptism, for the way that Jesus teaches, and for how God deals with us. Back to the passage. Matthew chooses this moment of Jesus' baptism, early on in this book, to give us a glimpse of the nature of God and what he's all about. In that moment, when God the Father speaks from heaven, it's this supernatural odd little moment to us. But don't over-focus on that and miss the significance of what God says and when he says it. At this point in the story, in Jesus' early life, earthly life, I should say, he has done nothing. He hasn't started the public ministry that makes him famous. No miracles, no teaching. Basically, at this point, nobody has heard of him outside the little town of Nazareth, where he spends most of his life. And yet God the Father speaks over him and says, I'm pleased with you. The God of heaven, the creator of all things, says, I'm pleased with you and I love you. That's because the Trinitarian God is three persons who love and prefer one another endlessly. The Father has always loved the Son in this way. Think about how utterly and completely different this is from how our world works. To me, this is one of the most powerful moments in the entire Bible. It's unbelievable. In our world, of course, it's all about what you do from birth to death. You get love based on your performance. You get good grades at school, you get affirmed. You do your job well, you get a slap on the back. And more deeply than that, and you'll find this in probably all of your relationships, when you're consistently nice to people, they'll like you more. You do good to people and they'll be motivated to do good to you. Seems to be human nature. Our whole society is meritocratic, or at least it intends to be. In other words, you get things based on whether you deserve them. Many of us, I'm sure, will have had grown up with parents who communicated that if we did the right things, whatever those things were, we'd be loved more. And if we didn't, we wouldn't be loved so much. It might never have been said, but you knew it was true. You knew it was true. And so we've programmed ourselves to think that we have to prove ourselves, to perform, to do our best, because that's the path to being valued and truly receiving love. And in this one verse, God declares that it does not work that way with him. That's not him. The persons of the Trinity have eternally loved one another. Jesus does all the things that he does after this, all the stuff he does after this, as a response to the love of the Father, not to earn it. Might seem like a small thing, but it's massive. It's so amazing. Think about how practical this is. Because of the way our culture works, many of us, either consciously or unconsciously, hold the deep-seated, intense belief that we have to do all the right things to receive the love of God. And it's so deep-rooted, sometimes we can't even see it. I've been doing full-time Christian ministry in various forms for about 17 years now. And I would go as far as to say, virtually everyone's problems are rooted in a belief that they somehow need to perform and justify themselves through doing certain things. Even people who claim not to believe in God whatsoever are trying very hard to be approved, liked, accepted, loved by someone, even if they can't put a name on who. And even long-term Christians who know their stuff, you know, we would say, well, we know that's wrong. That's not how it is. We know that God loves us. We even know a few Bible verses that tell us so. But still, for some reason, it's a battle to believe it. When you become a Christian, there's a lifelong journey to take hold of the fact that God's love for you is not based on your performance. And if you get hold of it even a tiny bit, the freedom, the joy that brings is absolutely wonderful. Nobody else will treat you like this. Nobody else does what God does. Jesus ultimately ends up going to the cross, dying to pay for our sin, dying to pay for the sin of the world. He doesn't do that so that God loves us. He doesn't. He does it because God loved us already. That was the driver. Why else would he go through it? And when he does, The idea is that Jesus has swapped for us. We deserved the cross, but he takes it, which means we get to be in his position and all the benefits that that brings. We get seen how Jesus is seen. God looks every single one of his people in the eye and says, "This is my son whom I love. With him I'm well pleased." Or, "This is my daughter whom I love. With her I am well pleased." And so the whole thing Jesus is about, the kingdom he will speak about through this book, where God is king and his people gather around him, that's what Jesus' ministry is all about. It all launches from this moment. The Trinitarian God, the center of reality, is a being of loving personal relationships. His love for you is not, never has been, and never will be contingent on how you behave. Doesn't work like that. Many of us, probably all of us, need to take hold of this on a new level. We need to identify what lies we believe about ourselves and how they shape us. If you want to talk this through with somebody, because this is a huge thing, please do get in touch. I'd love to talk to you, or somebody from my church would love to talk this through, because this is life-changing stuff. But this whole thing is not supposed to just make us feel better, although hopefully we'll have that advantage. It's meant to change how we do all of life. On every level, what we see about God and his nature is meant to change how we do everything. How we see other people, how we see all of our relationships. You see, once you start getting hold of how God sees you, it opens up how you look at everybody else. I look at how God works, and I want to do the same with other people and in my relationships. My aspiration in life is to love other people in a way that means I'm immune to what they're like. I want to be immune to what they're like. That doesn't mean I wouldn't get hurt by what people say, or I wouldn't be disappointed or anything, but what I mean is I want to be able to love people in a way that's not at all shaped by how they behave. Honestly, it feels like a long way off, but that's the plan. That's the intention. One of the ways I'm working on this is with my daughter. Now, many of you will know my little girl, Anita. She's 5 years old. She's fantastic. Love her to bits. And if there's anyone that you could love with that, with no strings attached, it's your kids, right? But even then, we don't love our kids perfectly, of course. And with my daughter, and I'm sure it'll be true with my son when he gets a bit older and start having to look after him in different ways, I'm determined that she doesn't grow up thinking that I love her based on how well she's behaved. I absolutely don't want that. But it's really difficult because it may surprise you to learn she doesn't always do what I say. In fact, she's quite a strong-willed little girl. I have no idea at all where she gets that from, but she's a very strong-willed little character. And we have our moments. We have our moments where I have to lay down the law, I have to do the sort of classic old-school parental discipline. And it's really hard with kids because, of course, you need to teach them right and wrong. They need to know how to behave in different situations, and it's good parenting to teach them that. But I desperately don't want her to grow up believing that the love of her dad is something that is earned. It's supposed to be just something that is. And so I tell her I love her all the time. You know, first thing in the morning, last thing before she goes to bed, and loads of times in between. Tell her it all the time. But in particular, I've made the decision that even when she's at her most difficult, her most challenging, her most annoying, and I'm having to be really, really clear with strong words that her behaviour is not acceptable, that's when I make extra sure in the midst of that to tell her that I love her as well. That it's not behaviour based, that I love her regardless. And then hopefully she knows, even when I'm very annoyed, she hears it, and so the message becomes that I'm disciplining her because I love her, not that I'm threatening to withdraw love. Now, our children, of course, hear all the time they need to behave well, and of course they need to learn that, but they desperately need to hear that they are loved regardless of what they do. And actually, I'm convinced knowing they are loved shapes their character for the better in the long run anyway. So there is meant to be a direct relationship between what God is like and how we relate to other people, whether it's children or grown-ups or everything in between. He models it, we follow it. And you know, I think Christians often get a bad reputation. Sometimes it's unfair, sometimes it isn't. We can be known for our moral positions more than for loving people regardless of what they're like. But imagine if we were more like God in this. Imagine if our love for others really was unrelated to how they behaved. If we were immune to their behaviour in our love for other people. This is exactly what the world needs. But it has to start with exactly what we see in this passage. The God who is one and yet three persons, eternally self-giving and loving. There really could be no better thing at the heart of reality than a God who is and always has been love, and who became, in one of these three persons, became human, came into our world, identified as one of us, invited us into that love relationship, invited us into the dance, so to speak, and who says to every single one of his people, whatever we have done, whatever we will do, he says to every one of his people, including you if you're a follower of Jesus, this is my son whom I love, with him I'm well pleased. This is my daughter who I love, with her I am well pleased. Couldn't be better news. Have a great week.